We got one more guest, one more segment here for this January 15th edition of Bang the Book Radio. That is Wes Reynolds, at Wes Reynolds, the number one on Twitter, host and contributor to VSiN. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Hey, Adam, how are you this afternoon?
Doing very well, buddy. Appreciate your time, as always, man. Thank you so much for joining me. And let's talk real quickly about the College Football National Championship game, because you did a bet cast over on VSiN, so you were following along. I'm sure you had some prop action as well. Is that the way you expected that game to go?
Yes and no. I mean, no in the fact that look, I would, like many others, was on Clemson plus the points at six. But I'm not shocked and I'm not necessarily dissatisfied, even though that bet didn't get there, in terms of the result. Because, look, when you're looking at this, just separating your better hat from being a fan, you're looking for the best team to win the championship and in any sport, and the best team did, I think, on Monday night. I think LSU was proved to be the best team. This is a team that did beat seven teams in the top 10 at the time that they played them. This is a team that ended up being in the preseason polls, that ended up beating the top four teams. They beat Oklahoma. They beat Clemson. They beat Georgia. They beat Alabama. So this really, to me, is an undisputed national champion. Yeah, there were a couple shaky calls, but I don't think it determined the game. The Skowski ejection was big in the second half, and the offensive pass interference may not have been the right call there. But I think you could tell at that point, in terms of the momentum of the second half, that LSU had all the momentum, and it almost seemed like if you were just hanging on and it was a matter of time before that they were going to put some distance between the two teams, and they absolutely did.
Well, and I think too, you know, and we talk about this all the time on the show, sort of the difference between betting and handicapping. And from a handicapping standpoint, you could have obviously made a case for Clemson. I said as much on the show. I said, look, I have to take Clemson, but I wouldn't be surprised if LSU wins this game and does so comfortably, because the handicap was kind of up in the air. But from a betting standpoint, the overreaction within that line, based on a one-game sample size, was too much for a lot of us to pass up. It was 3, 4, 5 points of line value from what it would have been a few weeks prior.
Right.
And that's the betting side of it. You know, in the handicapping side, yeah, the outcome isn't particularly surprising. The game could have gone either way, I think, from a handicapping standpoint. But as bettors, we took what we perceived to be line value, and it didn't get there. And
yeah,
if you're going to give somebody 3 to 4 points of betting line value, that a lot of people are taking Clemson in that game. And maybe if you run it back 10 times, Clemson wins 5 or 6 of them. But in that one game sample, it was LSU. It was Joe Burrow. It was arguably the greatest single season in college football history from a quarterback. It's not surprising. But again, from a betting standpoint, Clemson probably was the side.
Yeah. And it ends up being, look, we try to look and analyze these games in various different ways, in terms of fundamental handicapping, in terms of situational, in terms of statistics and analytics. But oftentimes, I guess what it comes down to something that's pretty simple. Pick the winner. Pick who you think's going to win the game, and where the spread doesn't necessarily always come into play. In fact, more often than not, it doesn't, and it didn't Monday night.
All right, so we take a look here at these games on Sunday, and I think this is a perfect segue, because I had a long discussion on yesterday's show with Brian Blessing, gotten some positive feedback about that, about all the things that have gone into these two conference championship game lines. San Francisco up from -7 to 7.5, game 3-11, 3-12. The NFC championship game first on the board by rotation order, so that's why we talk about that one first. But what stands out most to me about this one, Wes, and I'm sure you've already talked about this on your stuff over the last couple of days, is that San Francisco opened 6.5 against Minnesota, got bet to 7. This one opened 7, got bet to 7.5. Very telling, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I obviously would want to lay 7 rather than 7.5. And the line on the surface for a game like this looks a little high, but you know, maybe kind of considering it, maybe the 49ers are still a little bit underestimated in the market, as absurd as that sounds. Because when you look at that, all the stuff, all the DVOA and all the team efficiency metrics, the 49ers are better than this team. And the fact that, look, you had a Packer team. The Packer team was really the only team that got off to a home team last week that got off to a good start. I guess the 49ers did too, but Minnesota went right down the field and scored on them the next drive. So every team, we obviously saw it with Kansas City, and then we obviously saw it with Baltimore, and they ended up losing. Green Bay was the only team that got off to a good start, but they were holding on for dear life at the finish. They actually got outgained by Seattle eventually in that game. And Seattle, I think, was clearly the better team in the second half, but just they got in that hole early and couldn't quite dig their way out. And then we look at the fact that we obviously have a rematch from what we saw on a Sunday night football game, I think in week 12. And you look at it and how dominant really the 49ers were. Last week you looked at Devontae Adams, who was like, I think, 66% of the Packers' passing yardage. He had 8 catches, 160 yards, and 2 touchdowns. And that was basically why Green Bay won the game, because Seattle couldn't cover him. But you look at what he did against San Francisco, he had 43 yards on 11 targets in week 12. Aaron Jones was another key to the offense, had 2 touchdowns against Seattle last week. He only had 38 yards on 13 touches. And we saw a 49er defense that took Dalvin Cook away last week, 15 carries, 26 yards. And I think when you look at what happened with the 49ers too last week, they got healthy on defense. So the bye week ended up working for them because they got Tart back in the secondary. They're kind of their stud safety. They got Quan Alexander back, and they got Dee Ford back. And when they've had those three guys on the field, because those guys have kind of been a little bit in and out of the lineup this year, they're only allowing like around 12 points a game when they're really at full strength with those three guys who have been out. So you look at the fact that this is getting a 7.5, and I hope maybe 7 shows, because I think Green Bay, I think these are games that will end up getting at least close to 2-way action. So you may see some 7s again once this gets to 7.5. But I do almost think the 49ers are really undervalued in the market because they're new here. They're new to this territory. And I guess as is Tennessee, and we'll get to that in the second game. But, you know, these other teams, Kansas City, Green Bay, New Orleans, Seattle, the Patriots, these teams have all been here before in these games. And the 49ers, this isn't a vintage playoff team where it's like, okay, they got to get the wild card and they got to fail. They got to lose in the divisional round, or they got to lose in the conference championship game, where usually you got to fail once or twice before you break through and potentially get to the Super Bowl. And you got a 49er team that, you know, first time in the playoffs under this Shanahan John Lynch regime, and maybe they can just get there right away. They've been building something, and I think they've clearly been the best team in the NFC this year.
Yeah, and again, I mean, you know, we talk about narrative, we talk about recency bias kind of shaping this market a little bit. I do agree with you. I think 7 does come back here because some people are going to whittle this handicap down to something very simple of Aaron Rodgers versus Jimmy Garoppolo. And I don't know how Garoppolo plays. I don't know how Rodgers plays. I can take a very simplified point of view, obviously, but that sentiment will be out there, especially with the amount of public betting action that's going to come in on this game. So maybe that does drive this back down to 7 at a few of the places out there. The other thing that's worth mentioning is that in that Sunday night meeting, San Francisco was -3 against Green Bay. So we have seen an adjustment, maybe relative to that data point. But keep in mind, too, that the prior 3 games for San Francisco before that Green Bay game failed to cover at Arizona and really could have lost that game on the road against the Cardinals. They were a 10-point favorite, 1-3. Did lose to Seattle at home, laying 6.5, and then did push against Arizona at home, laying 10, but they needed that weird, ridiculous touchdown at the end of the game in order to cover that, or in order to push that number and cover for anybody who got 9.5. So they weren't playing well going into that Green Bay game where you got the -3. They're better now. They're healthier now, as we all know. This line, you're right, this line may be a little bit cheap at 7.5, and yet 7 still probably coming back, largely because of that Rodgers versus Garoppolo consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great point that you made, Adam, in terms of look, lines get adjusted based on results, and they clearly were in that Sunday night game, because I ended up not betting that game because I wasn't sure where to go, even though I thought the 49ers were better. I ended up passing on that game because I thought, well, you know, are they kind of coming back to earth a little bit? And you just weren't sure. And look, Green Bay was my pick before the season to reach the Super Bowl. But you do adjust your opinions as much. And credit Green Bay, they've had a very good season. But we talked about it last week when we were analyzing the game with Seattle. Those were two teams that you almost wanted to bet against in terms of those are two teams whose records maybe are a little bit better than they are as a team. This is not the vintage Green Bay Packers team when they were making runs under McCarthy, when they were just kind of a little bit of a video game type offense and they could just outscore teams. That's not this bunch here for Green Bay.
Well, and again, I'll bring up what I brought up yesterday because I want to get your take on this a little bit too. You know, last week, Green Bay, 5.9 yards per play in the first half. That was a half yard above their season average. Held Seattle to 5 yards per play. Take a 21-3 lead into the intermission. In the second half, they quit playing. I mean, they sat on the lead. They kind of played prevent. They didn't take any chances whatsoever. And it nearly cost them. So how do we evaluate Green Bay from last week? Do we look at what was a statistically dominant performance in the first half? Or do we look at the fact that they only won that game 28-23, didn't end up covering the closing number of 5.5, if that's what you had to take? Obviously, if you took 5.5, you should probably be doing something else. But how are people going to evaluate that Green Bay performance last week? Because the first half was good, and they had a big lead. Do we hold the second half against them?
Right. And when I was talking about San Francisco kind of, this being new territory for the whole team and the whole organization, this is also new territory for this Green Bay staff, especially Matt LaFleur. And I mean, and this Green Bay, with a lot of the roster changes, I mean, Aaron Rodgers has certainly been in these spots before, but a lot of this Green Bay team has not. And a lot of most of this coaching staff has not been there before. So we're getting a couple, I guess, unknowns here really with these two teams in this spot. So yeah, that's why I think the 49ers, why I don't think that this line is necessarily too high, because you're getting an unknown commodity, I think, with Green Bay as well.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And let's transition over to the other game here, where again, we've got an unknown commodity with the Tennessee Titans, not just with their personnel being in this spot for the first time, but also with their coaching staff, you know, by and large being in this spot for the first time, not defensive coordinator Dean Pease. He was certainly there a lot with Baltimore, but still kind of an unknown here. You know, it's wrong to call them a flavor of the month team. They've been basically a flavor of the second half team because they've been so good since Ryan Tannehill took over, but you've got a 7.5 here as well with Kansas City, the home favorite, this total much higher than the other total of 52.5. I'm curious to see what happens here with this number and how these two teams are evaluated, because the perception of Tennessee, despite not going 13-3, not winning their division, probably higher than the perception of Green Bay right now.
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. And I was just going to say that. I think you've seen this Tennessee dog take a lot more support than Green Bay. I think I was talking about this with Jeff Sherman over at the Westgate Superbook USA yesterday, and Ed Sammons, who's kind of mainly their main NFL odds maker over there at the Westgate. It's a collaborative effort, but Ed really is kind of the head guy or the point man on that sport. They opened this 9.5 on Sunday as the games were going on, and it kept just dropping and dropping because Jeff would send updates on his Twitter feed, and it just kept dropping and dropping. And when it got to 7, that's when you kind of started to see some resistance on Kansas City. So that looks like that's going to be the bottom point in terms of that. When it gets to 7, you get the Kansas City money back. But Tennessee got a ton of support. And I think that this is a tougher from the side. This is a tougher game to handicap, because with Tennessee, sometimes you got to realize you do get a hot team that gets on a run late in the postseason. And usually you kind of want to go against the hot team, but this is a team that that look, credit to them, fair play. They've won three straight road games because keep in mind they won against Houston. Now, Houston sat some guys because they had clinched the AFC South Division title. So they sat guys, but Tennessee got Derrick Henry back because remember, he didn't play against New Orleans and they were right in the game against New Orleans in the second half until there was a hit and then a fumble and then New Orleans got a score to kind of put the game away. But yeah, Tennessee has won three in a row. They've been doing it with the running game. Ryan Tannehill has been okay. Not really great statistically because he doesn't have 100 yards passing in either of the two playoff games. But they've been able to figure it out and get it done. But at the same time, if you're back in the Titans, you got to look at Kansas City and say, is this team really going to come out flat 2 weeks in a row? Because they were absolutely flat. Everything went wrong. They had the blocked punt and they got in a big hole early. And then they went on a 51-7 run to end up winning the game by 20 points and covering easily. So yet another win for Andy Reid off the bye. Probably what I'm looking at here, Adam, now that we're seeing now 53s on the total, this did go up from 51. I think when we talked about the recency bias, bettors betting what they bet last, they're going to bet the over when you saw 82 points scored in Kansas City and you saw Kansas City's defense, I guess, maybe revert a little bit, even though it was much better in the second half, revert a little bit back to what their form was, because coming into the playoffs, they had only allowed 69 points in six games. But in that stretch, they were playing a couple teams that were very much in transition. You played the Bears. You played the Raiders. Teams that weren't automatically great offenses week to week. And so perhaps that inflated those numbers. One of the things I look at, and I do like the under here, and probably am going to play that, even though they have one of the best offenses in the league, even though they play with high totals and score points, under Reid, the Chiefs actually in Arrowhead are 36-23-1 to the under, and that includes the playoffs. Reid has actually been the most profitable coach in the playoff, or actually since 2013, just overall, has been the most profitable coach to the under, which is really weird because this is such an explosive offense with Kansas City. So the under probably is my definite in terms of the side. I want to say Kansas City's not going to come out flat again, but anything over seven, I do think represents just traditional pure line value to Tennessee.
You know, I have a tough time with the side here for this one. I mean, I did like the over a little bit earlier on in the week, almost kind of a bailout play in the preview I wrote over at bangthebook.com, just because the side is a little bit questionable here for this one. I don't think it's as clear cut as it is in the NFC Championship game. But you look back to last week's game, and I know Derrick Henry ran roughshod as he has the last 3 weeks, as he has all season long. Baltimore's drives. They get to the Tennessee 36. Lamar throws a pick. It gets returned 30 yards and then a 15 yarder on top. So Tennessee short field, they score a touchdown 35 yard drive. Next possession, Baltimore 4th-and-1 at the 45, terrible play call, turn it over on downs. Tennessee scores with a long pass next play. 3-play punt drive. Then they get a field goal drive going down to the Tennessee 31, field goal drive at the Tennessee 4 going into halftime, drive coming out of the half, turn it over on another 4th-and-1 at the 18. This was kind of a theme for Baltimore throughout the game. They moved the football, but they bogged down on 4th down, or Lamar Jackson had some ill-timed turnovers, a turnover with a pick at the 31, the turnover at the 36, the short field turnover in his own territory. Baltimore moved the football in Tennessee. So I sort of wonder, again, from a score standpoint, it looks like a dominant performance for Tennessee. Lamar Jackson had over 500 total yards in this game. Baltimore moved it. They just screwed up when they moved it. So how is that going to be evaluated as we get deeper in the week and closer to the game here with regards to Kansas City and what they do offensively? Maybe 7.5 does hang around here from a side standpoint.
Yeah, and that is a very good point that you make, because this wasn't just it looks, when you look at the score, like an ass kicking. But it really wasn't. You did have Baltimore moving the ball. They just made mistakes. And And I think, look, you're going to get playoff jitters. It's that old rest versus rust theory that you have, where it's like the whole narrative and everything that you get, only one side of the story really gets told in the media when they're previewing and analyzing all of these games. It's like, oh, you get the bye week and you get healthy. Yes, that's true, but you also get rusty. We saw it in the national championship game, which ended up having 67 points scored, where the winner scored 42. Those two teams were rusty early, and that's why that's such, usually such a more often than not a profitable prop bet, one that I make in most Super Bowls, is that no score in the first 6 minutes and 30. I think it was 5:30 for the national championship game, and you didn't see LSU and Clemson score for several minutes because, look, they hadn't played in 16 days. And so sometimes that's what you get in that divisional round off a first round bye. You get some rust, and you clearly got it for Baltimore, and it ended up putting it in a hole. But then when they kind of got it going, they really shot themselves in the foot more often than not.
And really, it was 2 weeks off or 3 weeks off for Baltimore because they didn't play anybody in week 17.
Right.
So you kind of wonder about that. I mean, obviously, you don't want to put Lamar Jackson at risk, but maybe you treat that like a preseason game where he comes out, plays a quarter, goes through the motions, this and that, stays sharp, and then you go into that bye week in the playoffs. So maybe some second-guessing there for Harbaugh. People were obviously second-guessing the fourth-down play calls and stuff like that. I don't have any issue really with what Harbaugh did for the most part. Again, trying to spark his team, looking at the numbers, looking at the percentages, stuff like that. But you wonder here if Kansas City is able to execute better on fourth down, in some of those third down situations, in the red zone in particular, and if that's just too much for Tennessee to overcome. So should be interesting, but I agree with you again, you know, from a betting standpoint, taking it under when a total peaks does make some sense here. And I don't know if this game goes over. I don't know if this game goes under, but if you've got under 53 in pocket, you know, you're going to get the best of it for sure, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure if it's going to tick up maybe a little bit more, or if you have a lot of people that we kind of think alike here where it's like, okay, you know, maybe this is getting just a bit too high.
All right, so let's talk some golf here to finish out this Wednesday edition of the show, because we've actually got two notable golf events here. The European Tour event, probably a little bit more notable and certainly an easier handicap, not having three different courses to worry about. But that's the HSBC Abu Dhabi Championship over on the European Tour side of things. Very, very good field, as you would expect here for a tournament of this magnitude. Fleetwood, the favorite. You've got a lot of North American players going over there. A Patrick Cantlay, a Brooks Koepka, Bryson DeChambeau. And then, of course, all the European Tour fixtures as well. Like an Oosthuizen, Fitzpatrick, Shane Lowry, stuff like that. How'd you handicap this one over in Abu Dhabi, Wes?
Yeah, with Abu Dhabi, I went a little bit down from the favorites, but I didn't necessarily take some bombs here like I did in the other event. You look at the top of the leaderboard, and Koepka is not even the favorite because there's question about the fitness, even for the world number one. He certainly has experience because he really cut his teeth on the European Tour, but I still think that's a risky proposition to bet him at such a short price because you don't know if he's going to be ready. He has not played since October. So that's the old rest versus rust that I like to talk about. Pat Cantlay and Bryson DeChambeau kind of new to playing in the Middle East. So I thought, and then Tommy Fleetwood, considering that he's won two of the last 3 years, and Lowry won last year, so you're not going to get bargains on those guys because they have pedigree. But I went with some guys that I think have played well in the Middle East in the past, and then some guys that I think their games are starting to peak. The guys I played Thomas Peters at 25-1. I think he's in very good form, like the way he ended the year. Keep in mind, too, we're starting this European Tour season, and that's one of the reasons why Victor Hovland is playing over, who hasn't won yet on the PGA Tour, but it's a matter of time why he's playing over here, because you have to play so many events on the European Tour to be able to qualify for Ryder Cup selection. So that's why you're really seeing that, and this is such a big year, so you got these guys wanting to get off to a huge start. Peters, a guy that just missed the team last time, certainly is going to want to show his mettle and return to the Ryder Cup team for Whistling Straits. So I have him, Sergio Garcia. I got him at 30, missed some of the 40s, but a guy that plays really well, that's won in Dubai, that's won in Qatar. So he's a guy that could go well. Martin Keimer is really the form guy because he's won the most of these events. This is a tournament's only been around maybe a little over 15 years. Martin Keimer's won 3 times and actually probably should have won 4 because back in 2015, he actually had a 10-shot lead that he blew. And that's when Gary Stahl beat him and Rory McIlroy by a shot. So Martin Keimer makes sense. Danny Willett makes sense. A guy that has won in Dubai, won the DP World Tour Championship a couple years ago. He's really kind of become a big game hunter where he's a little inconsistent, but he shows up in some of the big events on the European Tour. Thomas Detry, this is a guy that's kind of going to be like my Jorge Campillo from last year, where you bet him until he wins because he's getting a ton of top five. He's knocking on the door. And the young Belgian, I think, is going to win 50-1. And then I took a couple 100-1 shots. Andy Sullivan and Adriaanos. Sullivan was second in ball striking last week in South Africa. So those were more speculative plays on that side.
All right, so we come back over stateside here, an event over in California. The California Swing, very kind to very select group of guys out there. I'm sure Brant Snedeker will play well here in one of these events coming up. He's actually not in this one here this weekend, but this is the American Express, formerly the Bob Hope Classic, the Desert Classic, Career Builder Challenge. This thing's changed names a ton, but now it's called the American Express. Ricky Fowler, 11-1, Sungjae Im, 13, Finau, Casey, Benny On, Billy Horschel, some of the guys next up there on the board. This is a really difficult handicap because you've got 3 different courses in play, 54-hole cut, bunch of celebrities wandering around, a lot of distractions, a tough handicap to be sure.
Yeah, this is, and I was mentioning that earlier this week. So this is kind of a dart throw event. I mean, you don't really get a lot of shorter price guys win here. John Rahm did 2 years ago at 10-1, but he had to go to a playoff against Andrew Landry. And when you have these birdie fests, and especially the hardest course is going to be the Pete Dye Stadium course that everybody's going to play on Sunday after the 54-hole cut. But the other two courses, the Nicklaus Tournament course and the La Quinta Country Club, those courses are much easier than the Pete Dye course. So that's something to keep in mind if you're doing any in-play for this event, which may be the best way to approach it. But yeah, I took some longer shots here and threw some darts. Brendan Todd was my shortest guy at 50-1. Guy that's in really good form. Won back-to-back events at Mayakoba and I think the Dominican in November. So this is a guy that's a decent price at 50-1 in pretty good form. Couple guys that have won on desert golf courses before, most notably Montreux, where they play the Lake Tahoe event, which is a Stableford scoring event where you got to make a lot of birdies. Vaughn Taylor is a guy I looked at there. He's 60-1. Andrew Putnam has also won there, 60-1. I played him. And then a couple of the longer bombs, Rory Sabatini, 80-1. Hadn't won anything since 2011, but won the QB shootout with Kevin Tway in Naples back in December. And guy maybe that could go really well here. Sabatini was interesting because he actually changed his citizenship. His wife and his stepson are from Slovakia. So Rory Sabatini, that's kind of the big joke where Sabatini is now from Slovakia. He also did that too to try to get eligible to be able to play in the Olympics in Tokyo in 2020, because that's a guy that's going to be ranked 9th or 10th in terms of South African players and wouldn't be able to make the team. So changed his citizenship accordingly. Carlos Ortiz, 100-1, guy that has 3 top 4 finishes in the fall series, got out on the tour for the Battlefield promotion a couple years ago from the thenweb.com tour. A guy I think could play pretty well on these West Coast type of birdie fest. And then Bo Hogue, 150-1. He was on the lead on Saturday. He's a PGA Tour rookie from Ohio State. Did have a piece of the lead on Saturday before he ended up finishing 9th at the Sony. And the same with Tom Hogue, different spelling, H-O-G-E, at 200-1. Guy that's played good desert courses. He had his best PGA Tour finish last fall with a second at the Greenbrier. So one of these guys that kind of tends to show up on these courses where and on these events where you got to shoot in the mid 20 unders to get a win here. So this is an event where probably if you're not doing a lot of pre-flop, maybe you can do some in play if you have that available to you. But kind of a graveyard of favorites here, even though you've had some big names win here in the past.
A lot of good golf betting thoughts and a lot of good NFL playoff thoughts as well here on today's show from Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. As I mentioned, you can hear him on VSiN. And Wes, when can people hear you on VSiN?
Okay, I will be back usually on Thursday, but we'll be back this week on Friday. I will personally be on from 8 to 10 Pacific PM. And then Saturday and Sunday, we do the Green Zone 2 to 6 on Saturday. 3 to 7 on Sunday. These are all Pacific times, by the way. So we will be in on Sunday during the two conference championship games. Myself and Jeff Parles will be along with me this week. So should be a lot of fun and definitely a lot of activity this time of year.
Yeah, there definitely is. And once again, make sure you follow Wes on Twitter at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Wes, appreciate your time as always, man. Thank you so much for joining me, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You got it, Adam. Always a pleasure.